least understood regions of the world, and I would be happy to meet with any one of you, alone or in a group, to discuss that aspect of it further. So now, let's get on with the program. It is indeed my great pleasure to introduce today's speaker, Mr. Michael Levine. But before I do, let me ask that you switch off your cell phones, which I just did, and pages and all questions and comments until the end of the program, when the firm's associate director, Daniel Mandel, is here, will conduct a question and answer session. So we will have time after Michael presents his formal remarks for you to have an exchange of ideas of questions with him. Dr. Michael Levine holds the Freedom Chair at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C., an organization of renown which you probably, I assume, have heard of. And it's one of the world's leading authorities on intelligence, contemporary history, and international affairs. In a few years in government, he carried out some of the most sensitive and dangerous missions in recent American history. He has been profiled in the New York Times and was the subject of a front page article and the lead editorial in the Wall Street Journal. A profile then concluded, and I quote, "A portrait emerges of a man with an intense knowledge of 20th century history, a deep commitment to democracy, and a willingness to be adventurous. This is a man who has helped shape American foreign policy at its highest levels," end quote. As Ted Koppel puts it, Michael Levine is a Renaissance man in the tradition of Machiavelli. Formerly Rome correspondent with the New Republic, the founding editor of the Washington Quarterly and contributing editor of National Review Online. He's a regular contributor to the Wall Street Journal, the International Economy, the American Spectator, the New York Sun, and the National Review. A long list of credentials. Andrew's an advisor to multinational corporations in Europe, Africa, and the United States, and a corporate director in America and Africa. He also writes about contract bridge for the Wall Street Journal and the New York Sun.
Why are you laughing?
Dr. Levine is a celebrated scholar and lecturer. He holds a PhD in history and philosophy from the University of Wisconsin and has been the recipient of many awards and research grants. His 15 books include Brave New World, which predicts the crisis of the Soviet Empire 5 years before it occurred, Machiavelli on Modern Leadership, which is 1999 publication, Help Them on American Character, and his highly successful book, The War Against Terror Matters. I urge you, if you have not read it, to please read it, as I do, you'll find it extremely informative. The War Against the Terror Matters, how it happened, and where we are now, how we will win. He's currently writing a book on Naples, Italy. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in giving a warm welcome to Michael Levine.
Thank you. I will encourage you to interrupt because in my experience, I think for mental health, it's very bad to hold things in. So if anything I say prompts you to want to cry out, either in admiration or in rage, please do cry out. I'm going to try to review the bidding on what's going on in the Middle East and why we're there and who we're fighting and all of that, because there's a tendency to forget always, because we all get caught up in today's news. All right, the basic principles are these. Number one, the terror war is not new. It didn't start on September 11th. It's, in fact, very old. It's at least a quarter of a century old. And you can date it to various things. You can date it to the Iranian Revolution of 1979. You can date it to the Marine Barracks bombing of the early 1980s. But, I mean, wherever you date it, there's a good long tradition behind it. So we've been under attack, American diplomats, American businessmen, American targets, symbols, and so forth, all over the world. North America, South America, Middle East, Asia, so forth. There isn't a continent on which something hasn't happened in the last 25 years, long before September 11th. September 11th happened because prior to September 11th, it was a one-sided war. They were attacking us. We were not responding. In that entire period, so far as, you know, serious response, America's response to being attacked by a vast terror network, about which we have always known a considerable amount, consisted in bombing Tripoli, Libya, for half a day. American planes flew over Libya, dropped some bombs, came back. That was it. And it was symptomatic that when we went to the government of France, at the time, the socialist government of France, and asked for permission for those planes to fly over France on route to Libya, which would have saved many hours for our pilots, the response of the French government was, are you serious about getting rid of Gaddafi, or is this another one of your gestures? If it's one of your gestures, it's better you take the long way. If you're serious about getting rid of Gaddafi, not only can you fly over France, but we'll join with you. We have the Foreign Legion. We have tanks. We're right there. We're on the ground. You know, yes.
Is it before or after Lockerbie?
Before.
Before.
Long before.
Yes.
And we said, well, you know, this is just a one-shot thing, and so we took the long route and so forth. You know, so much to say. And this was Reagan. And Reagan still has a reputation of having been a real tough guy. In all that period, the one 24-hour period in which we bombed Tripoli, Libya, was the sum total of our waging war against terrorism. Every president since Jimmy Carter has declared war on terrorism. George W. Bush is the first American president to actually wage war on terrorism. That's one of the things that distinguishes him. Now, who are we at war with? Right, now this, you're involved with Middle East Forum, which is a truly great organization. And when you heard about all these hits on the website, I am one of the hitters, because I'm on there 3-4 times a week, every week, and I read Middle East Quarterly religiously and all of this stuff. However, I have to say that the terrorist forces that have attacked and are attacking us, while they include radical Islamists, they are not only radical Islamists. And the countries that support them include radical Islamic regimes, but they're not solely radical Islamic regimes. And it's important to understand this. I think it's enormously important to understand this. Prior to the liberation of Iraq, the countries that I call the terror masters were basically four: Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Saudi Arabia. Of these four countries, two are indeed wacko Islamic fundamentalists. That's Saudi Arabia with the Wahhabis and Iran with the Khomeini version of Shiism. The other two Ba'athist countries, Syria and Iraq, are not only not wacko Islamic countries, they're not religious at all. Neither the Assads nor Saddam had any kind of religious standing. In fact, the Iranians had to vouch for the Assad family before the Shiites in Syria would permit him to be sworn in as president. And Saddam, I mean, these people attracted a lot of sympathy in the Western world and a lot of support from the Western world precisely because they weren't radical Islamic fundamentalists, right? I mean, why did the whole West love Saddam so much for such a long time? Because he was the opposite of the crazy Iranians. And so in the Iran-Iraq War, there was a basic propensity in the West to root for and to help Saddam, because Saddam was an Arab socialist, secular Arab socialist. He wasn't. Only in the last few years that Saddam, having noticed the utility of radical Islam, suddenly announced to the world that he had donated 60 pints of his own blood so that an entire Quran could be written in it and then displayed in a museum outside Baghdad. Right, whether it's true or not, no one knows. But I don't think we're going to do DNA testing on it. But, you know, maybe Geraldo.
There was a report that two of those times were actually watered down ketchup.
Well, I don't know. I suppose, you know, some television program will do it tonight. In their desperate search to fill empty hours, anything will do. So what I'm saying to you is that the world with which we are at war can't be characterized in that kind of simple language. It's not just radical Islam. It's other things. The one thing that all the terror masters have in common is tyranny. They're all tyrants. And they all dread us and hate us because we threaten their legitimacy. And the existence and success of the United States of America threatens them more than anything else that they can imagine. Because they all know, as Saddam knew and the Iranians know and the Syrians and the Saudis all know, that their people, who are living underneath a very oppressive tyranny, would much rather live like us than the way they are living today. And they all know it. And in the modern world, I mean, once upon a time, they could more or less lock out this kind of democratic or freedom virus. But nowadays, it comes in, just falls out of the sky on their heads. It's broadcast from everywhere. Internet gets it to almost every place. I mean, it's really quite amazing. I don't know how many of you either have the time or the inclination to go online and see what's happening. But the best source of news on countries like Saudi Arabia, Iran, and Syria today comes from, and Iraq, comes from internet bloggers. And if you go to these sites, you will find everything from dentists in Baghdad to businessmen in Basra to some as yet unknown, we don't know who he is, some guy somewhere in Saudi Arabia who writes a hilarious and brilliant web blog called The Religious Policeman, which is the perfect name for a guy reporting from Saudi Arabia. And you get first-hand information day after day from people who are actually living there. You don't have to worry about having it filtered by some evening news broadcaster or some New York Times editor or whatever it may be. I mean, you get it firsthand. These people say, you know, here's what's going on. And if you have questions, you can email them, and they will answer you, and you can start dialogues and so forth. Well, I mean, it works both ways. They, too, come online, go to American websites, and start asking questions of us. And we answer. Plus, the internet provides a remarkably secure kind of telephone conversation because you can, there's free international telephone calls through internet. I hope that isn't all too shocking to you. But, and so people can log on, and there are all kinds of tricky ways to log on using phone cards and public telephone booths and web cafes and so forth, where they can have quite secure conversations with people in the United States for several hours. And on average, about once a month, I go on with one of these Iranian radio stations in the United States and talk to people in Iran. And mostly, they have questions. Sometimes they have information. But mostly, they have questions about what is going on. Okay. So here it is. Why do they hate us? I mean, this question that everybody asks. Yes, Islam is a failed civilization. No question. But, I mean, all civilizations have their ups and downs. I mean, Islam has had good times and bad times. They're going through an especially bad time right now, no doubt about it. I mean, the world is in this peculiar political correct mode where they don't feel that they can criticize Islam, but the whole civilized world holds the Islamic world in near total contempt. I mean, everybody knows that Arabs aren't winning Nobel Prizes or sending people into space or developing new medical technologies and all of that. I mean, that's not a secret. They know it themselves. They're the first to tell you. So you have this funny juxtaposition. We know these things, but we can't criticize them, right? And you can't help them. You can just give them money and leave them alone and let them do things by themselves. Egypt, I mean, Egypt is a wreck, a catastrophe, right? And think of Bernard Lewis's categorization of what kinds of governments and peoples there are in the Middle East. You all know this, right? I mean, this is the best way to think about the Middle East. There are countries in which you have oppressive regimes which are enemies of the United States. And in those countries, the people love the United States because we're their only hope to get out from under the oppressive regime. Right? Then there are countries in which there are corrupt and oppressive regimes which are friends of the United States. And the people of those countries hate us because they hold us accountable for the corruption and oppressiveness of their regimes. And so in the first category, countries that hate us, people that love us, you have basically Iran and used to have Iraq. And the corrupt countries that are friends of ours where the people hate us, that's Egypt and Saudi Arabia, let's say for sake of argument. And then the last category is countries, those few countries, used to be two in number, in which both the government and the people are pro-American and like us, and those are the only two democracies, Turkey and Israel. There's nobody else.
Abu Dhabi.
Right? Huh?
Abu Dhabi.
Oh no, Abu Dhabi is a very dangerous country.
hemorrhage.
That stuff is not very dangerous. I mean, these are people who are funding terrorism. Hand over fist, they provide safe havens to terrorists. I mean, millions. Well, I mean, the UAE. I mean, and it all happens through Dubai. I mean, Dubai is the sort of headquarters for an awful lot of terrorist action, and above all, for money laundering and illegal shipment of weapons. Let me just make one point about it. There are 40 flights a day between Iran and Dubai, 40. And the biggest Iranian bank in the world outside Tehran is in Dubai. And that's a foundation bank controlled by Khamenei and Rafsanjani. Yes, ma'am.
Have you been sponsored by
Dubai? Yes, you bet. So, don't. I mean, the countries that are making the progress in that part of the world, in the Gulf region, are what they call gutter,
yes,
for some reason.
Yes.
And spelled Qatar. And Kuwait, which has, of all things, recently permitted women to vote, which is, of course, the beginning of the end for Kuwait. But anyway, I mean, yes, we treat that as a sign of progress.
And don't we treat those two countries as allies? We imagine to keep basing there, we imagine to keep the relations there?
Yes. Although some of our optimism, I mean, we'll see how that works out. I mean, we thought Saudi Arabia was an ally for a very long time. Right? And the Saudi case is instructive because Saudi Arabia shows that you can be both a friend and an enemy at the same time, which is Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is both a valuable ally and a mortal enemy. Right? They're a valuable ally because they've helped us out with a lot of things over the past, whether it's bases or intelligence or oil prices or, you know, whatever. And they're a terrible enemy because they fund the assembly line of little terrorists, all these radical schools and mosques all over the world that inculcate hatred of the West and their terrible slogans, kill a Jew and go to paradise, kill an American, go to paradise, and all of that. However, I want to put in a footnote to that. I am the first to condemn the Saudis and label these schools and mosques as a terrible risk. The mosques are doubly significant. Not only do the imams or the mullahs preach terrible sermons in the mosques, but they are operationally important because they know that in most of the Western world, the police and the intelligence services and so forth are very unlikely to send people into the mosques to try to find what is going on there. And so mosques are operational centers for terrorists. For a very long time, for example, I could not understand. I mean, I couldn't comprehend what happened on September 11th. I mean, September 11th is an intelligence operation, whatever else it is. Right? You have a group of people infiltrated into the United States, controlled by some central something. And then they come and they live in the United States for some period of time, from a few weeks to several months to a couple of years. And then at a certain moment, the instruction comes, right? Do it tomorrow. And they all obediently go and blow themselves up in these various places. Now, you know, I know a lot about intelligence. I've studied it a lot. And that degree of control is really amazing, it seemed to me. So I went around asking people, well, how could they have had the confidence? How could they have been so sure that when that instruction was given that these guys would carry it out? I mean, they're at a huge distance. They don't have daily contact. I mean, for a suicide terrorist, and we know a lot about the psychopathology of suicide terrorists, they need constant attention. I mean, from the moment they're recruited to the moment they commit the act, they're not left alone for a second. Just be left if you go, you know, Allah's waiting for you, the 72 virgins are waiting for you, your family's going to be so proud of you, the ulema's going to be proud of you, etc., etc., because it doesn't come spontaneously to people to blow themselves up, even to teenagers. Right? So, these guys didn't have any of that. And they were grown-ups. Plus, if you look at them, and the more you look at them, the more surprising the whole event becomes. These are people from good families. These are not, misery does not explain September 11th. Misery has nothing to do with September 11th. These are sons of doctors and lawyers and businessmen. as is Osama. Osama's the son of one of the richest men in the world. Right? So these are middle class and upper middle class people. These are people who studied abroad. These are people who spoke foreign languages. These are people who had every opportunity in life. And at a certain point, they decided to become terrorists. And you have to keep reminding yourself of this. These are not products of the schools and mosques. These are people who freely embrace terrorism. Right? Look at the guy who killed Daniel Pearl. Read Bernard Henri Lévy's account of the murder of Daniel Pearl. The guy who killed him was, for all practical intents and purposes, a Brit. He grew up in England. English was his native language. He went to British public schools. He was well educated. His family was well off. One day, he embraced this. He went for it. Why? How? Etc. Okay, we'll leave that for another time. But I mean, the basic answer is because it gave meaning to life for these people, paradoxically. I mean, it solved an existential crisis that they were undergoing. And I mean, it's important. It's not just indoctrination. Those people, the most important people, they weren't indoctrinated. They're not products of this assembly line. Okay. All right, so, you know, I want to remind. So how did it happen that these people scattered all over the United States, thousands of miles from their controlled people and so forth, not only carried it out, but their controlled people knew they were going to carry it out. They had to have confidence from the, is it the Mongolian candidate, the Manchurian candidate? You know, the answer is no. They were under constant attention, and the constant attention came from the mosque, and it came from the community within the mosque. And there were people inside the mosque who were charged with making sure that these people were in the proper frame of mind so that when the instruction came, they would carry it out. Right? We've paid insufficient attention to this whole question. Because we, as a country, are almost constitutionally incapable of dealing with this question. I mean, prior to, you all know, because I'm sure you've read Steve Emerson and so forth, prior to the September 11th, the FBI could not clip newspaper stories about radical religious leaders. They were not permitted to set foot inside a mosque. They were not permitted to attend rallies headed by radical jihadists. And they couldn't cut newspaper articles dealing with people who were openly calling for jihad in America. Couldn't touch it. Couldn't get anywhere near it. Forbidden. Illegal. Right? And so we are. How did we miss it? Right, and then we have these crazy commissions looking for, you know, the guilty party. Wasn't it? They did it themselves. Congress required all these regulations. Most of the strictures that were put on CIA and FBI came from Congress. It wasn't invented by themselves or government lawyers who were trying to make sure that they didn't communicate with one another and so forth. All of that came out of congressional scandals and congressional investigations. That's the basic cause. So asking Congress to investigate the cause of the pre-September 11th failure is like asking the madam to investigate the problem. I mean, it's the wrong person. You won't get the right answers. Okay, so that's why the mosques are not just a matter of indoctrination. The mosques are operational centers. If you look at Iraq today, what do you find? You find that Iran, which is the world's leading sponsor of terrorism and the number one problem in the Middle East, and the country we should have dealt with first, because we should have known, everybody should have known, and there was no excuse for not knowing, that if we went into Iraq without dealing with Iran first, that the Iranians, joined by the Syrians and the Saudis, were going to come after us. Because they have to come after us. Right? This is not hard to understand. Iran is a tyrannical fundamentalist regime that is hated by upwards of 70% of its own people. And those numbers don't come from us, they come from them. Because the Iranians, I mean, it's a kind of Laurel and Hardy kind of dictatorship sometimes. Because the Iranians actually go out and take public opinion polls. So if you're a citizen of Tehran, on any given day, you may be walking down the street, some guy will come up to you with a clipboard and say, "Hi, I'm Ali from the Information Ministry. I'd like to ask you a few questions about how do you feel about your government." Right? So you know it's a loyalty check. Then he says, you know, how do you like theocracy? How do you like Supreme Leader Khamenei? How do you like former President Rafsanjani and so forth? And upwards of 70% of Iranians say, I hate theocracy. I think Khamenei and Rafsanjani stink. I'd like to see them out or dead or so on and so forth. And I want freedom.
You mean they'll speak freely like that without the fear of secret police and the
White House? Yes. Yeah. Well, I mean, if you read even a totally corrupt journalist like Nicholas Kristof, who just went to Iran, wrote a series of articles in which he said he was absolutely astonished to discover that Iranians like Americans, love Americans, and hate their regime and aren't afraid. You know, he interviewed people and they said, this is a kind of fascist, disgusting regime and they're all thieves and bums and so forth. And he said, you know, can I quote you? And they said, yes. And he said, can I put your name in the paper? And they said, sure, put my name in the paper. I mean, they really hate it. And they've reached a point where they all know people who have been tortured to death or publicly executed and so forth, and they don't. And they're in such a gloom and despair in Iran nowadays that they're so contemptuous of this regime that they say, well, what does it matter? They're going to kill me now, they're going to kill me later, at least this way I get in my shot at them, right? I mean, and that the New York Times columnist should have been surprised to discover this is, of course, a scandal. Yet another scandal about the New York Times, because it had been written so many times by so many people and there were so many events to show it and document it and so forth, that for him to be surprised is truly scandalous. Shameful. No excuse for it. I mean, he's corrupt because he only believes things that he hears at his own dinner parties and his own cocktail parties from people who agree with him, which is the definition of intellectual corruption. I mean, he's just not, he's not a reporter. He doesn't go out and look for things because all this information was there. Look, the night of September 11th, tens of thousands of Iranians poured out into the streets of the major cities carrying lighted candles, mourning the people who died in New York. Right? And anybody who looks at Iran knows that story. And they did it and they've done it each anniversary. So it goes on over and over again. Right? So how could he not know, right?
Any possibility of overthrow? We keep hearing that the main government.
Yes, well, that's my main cause, you know, that's my... Yes. I mean, what it requires is money for the radio and television stations in Southern California who broadcast in Farsi a few hours a day. If they had more money, they could broadcast around the clock and they could have a stronger signal that would be harder to jam and so forth. Secondly, it requires that the Secretary of State say the same thing that the President does, which up until now has not happened, because the President keeps coming out and saying, well, you know, we're in favor of freedom for the Iranian people. You know, we don't like the government, we like the people, we stay with the people, we support their legitimate demand for freedom. And then Powell quickly comes out and says that we don't want to get involved in that family squabble in Iran. That's a phrase. And then Crazy Armitage comes out and says, Iran is a democracy. Right? I mean, if you live in Washington these days, you really have to wonder, at, you know, what is there something in the water that, you know, that does this to us? Because we're all crazy, definitely. Right? I mean, look at today's news. Right? I'm driving to the airport this morning, and I hear that we have now finally sent the troops to shut down Ahmed Chalabi. Right? So I remember what happened. Yeah. I mean, my first year in Washington, I was editing the Washington Quarterly, and I interviewed Moynihan. We tried to have one good interview in every issue. So I went and interviewed Moynihan. And, you know, you knew Moynihan was going to be a good interview. So at a certain point, we're talking about Carter. And Moynihan, it was late in the afternoon, so, you know, his thoughts were flowing. And he said, what's happened here is that he is no longer capable, speaking of Carter, of distinguishing between his friends and his enemies. And as usual, he said, that ends by adopting your enemy's view of the world, which was a great insight. Right? Terrific. So, I mean, we can say this now about, I think, safely about the State Department and the CIA, because, I mean, our best chance in Iraq, as in the Middle East generally, and I totally agree with the President, that this is a war of freedom against tyranny, and that the way to win it, the the best way to win it is to destroy the tyrannies and to spread freedom. And that's what's called them. That will do more than anything else. And it is fundamentally a political war, not a military war. And all this talk about military occupation and what we need in Iraq is more troops and all the rest of the stuff, it's nonsense. What we need in Iraq is less Iran. And we're having this trouble in Iraq because we didn't do Iran. And we're going to have to do Iran because there's no way out of it, because we can't have peace and stability in Iraq as long as those people are in power. Yes, sir?
I read recently that you argument made that if you grow up freedom, you will allow the Islamists to take advantage of the democratic process to effectively get in control for a one-time election as they tried in Algeria and as they ultimately
Well, the answer to that is that they are in control already, so you don't need an election to give control. Plus, we know, I mean, in Iran there's not the slightest doubt. I mean, no person with a turban will be elected to anything in Iran.
In Iraq.
Well, in Iraq it all depends. It all depends how well we do, and it depends on the context. Look, you know, all these people talking about, for example, Sistani. What does Sistani want? Right? Number one, Sistani wants to live. Right? And Sistani has seen his two closest and most important allies in Iraq and in the Iraqi Shiite community, Khoi and Hakim, both blown up by the Iranians. He doesn't want to be blown up by the Iranians. And so he, and every other Shiite in Iraq right now, has to sort of take out a bit of insurance with regard to Iran. I mean, the influence of Iran is absolutely enormous in Iraq. Now, I mean, sort of, yeah.
To Iran. What do you mean?
Iran, well, it's like the Philippines under Marcos or Yugoslavia under Milosevic. I mean, it's democratic revolution. There's a democratic
revolution.
We, the same way we did it in the Philippines and in Yugoslavia. We upped the broadcasting. We put these radio and TV stations on the air around the clock. We have Powell come out, and instead of saying we don't want to get involved in this family squabble, he comes out and says we want regime change in Iran.
We're going to keep going.
Yeah. They're going to do it. Revolution is done indigenously. It's not launched from... I mean, the son of the Shah is not going to leave the Iranian Revolution. Not going to happen. I don't know who is going to lead the Iranian Revolution, but whoever he is, he's in Iran today. He's not in Washington or Beverly Hills. Yeah.
I'm addressing myself to something. You mentioned that there is quasi freedom in Iran.
But no, there's not quasi freedom. What there is such. There's oppression in Iran, but they have reached a point where they're so contemptuous and hate the regime so much that they're speaking out anyway. It's just like what was going on in the Soviet Union at the end. The Soviet Union had gotten to this point. It wasn't free. It wasn't free.
So I would think that if I were approached, what is your opinion? I would not quite voice it.
Right, they're very brave. It's unusual. Yes. Anyway, I think you should probably stop and take questions, right?
Yes, yeah, that's right.
Right.
So let's have a first, or 21st.
Yeah,
go. In your remarks, you did not address directly the problems of Islam.
I am not a great scholar of Islam. But I am a great admirer of Bernard's. Bernard doesn't think so. Bernard thinks that Islam is perfectly capable of being, you know, a thoroughly civilized, tolerant, and modern faith. And if Bernard thinks so, I think that's probably right. And certainly the history of Islam, I mean, they've had terrific moments. Yeah.
It seems to me that if the regime comes close to collapsing in a revolutionary situation, when it loses confidence in itself, the greatest weakness of the Soviet regime was the doubts that Gorbachev and his immediate circle had about it, and we can all be very grateful for that.
Yeah.
For that. But do you see the leadership of Iran having any great doubts about its theocratic foundations or its need to survive?
Yes. Not so much its need to survive. They're very passionately committed to the need for them to survive. But they thoroughly doubt their own legitimacy. They know that people hate them. And I think they rather expect to be driven out in a relatively short period of time. Otherwise, why would they be exporting so much money? I mean, they're smuggling billions of dollars out of Iran to foreign bank accounts. And typically, that's the practice of people who expect to be overthrown. Yeah.
What would you generally see as triggering the
institutional
revolution? What could we look for? What could happen that all of a sudden they begin there?
Well, earthquakes are always good. No, really. I mean, historically, earthquakes, natural disasters are one thing that frequently kicks off revolutions. I'm writing a book about Naples, Italy, and in Neapolitan history, eruptions of Vesuvius and epidemics of disease have often been associated with revolutionary events.
And Chernobyl broke down.
Chernobyl was a big monster. I mean, things like that. But you don't require that. Look, our problem is that we're very bad at timing. You know, America is such a big country, and Americans feel so secure, despite September 11th. I mean, it's unforgivable that we should still feel secure, but by and large, we do. But, look, we went after Afghanistan. We destroyed the Taliban. We had al-Qaeda on the run. And then we waited 14 months before we did Iraq. That was unforgivable. And in those 14 months, we lost a huge amount of the international consensus that we had both before and after Afghanistan. I mean, post-Afghanistan, we were the Colossus of Rhodes. Nobody was going to mess with us. And nobody would criticize us because all the deep thinkers who would come out and had said Afghanistan was a quagmire, we were losing the war, the winter was, not even the great Soviet army could deal with winter in Afghanistan, winter was, a degree of ignorance of modern warfare really quite spectacular, because I know parenthetically, in modern warfare, what you want, the best thing you can possibly have, is a blanket of cold, because the things you want to kill are warm. And so when you have this terrific background of cold and a few warm things for your heat-seeking weapons, which is what most modern weapons are, I mean, it's a dream come true. I mean, bring on the winter. And one of the reasons why we were frustrated at the beginning was there wasn't enough snow and it wasn't cold enough. And the more it snowed and the colder it got, the better we did. So anyway, at the end of Afghanistan, everybody, all these tyrants all over the Middle East, were more or less convinced that their time had come. And it was at that moment that the Saudis trotted out, through Thomas Friedman, the legendary Saudi peace plan, which basically said, you can't invade Iraq until after you've solved the Israel-Palestine problem, right? And why did they do that? Because they were in dread that we were going to revolutionize the Middle East and that we were going to democratize the Middle East, and therefore they were going to go. Because they are, in that context, part of the problem. And so they had to find a way to stop us. And so they came up with that. All right, that set us back for a certain length of time. Then Blair came and said, look, I'll join with you, but I have to have UN resolutions because my lawyers tell me that if I join with you and we invade Iraq and we don't have a UN resolution, I'll be prosecuted for war crimes, either here in England or at the ICC or by this madman in Spain, Judge Garzón. Who wants to prosecute everybody. He would prosecute Castro. He's been great. He's been great on the Basques. I mean, there's a lot of things he does wonderfully well. He's done indicted three Algerians for 9/11 that most of the world didn't know about. No, no, I mean, there's the good stuff. But anyway, he prosecutes everybody, and he would love to prosecute Blair because that's more headlines. So Blair comes to us and says, we need a UN resolution. Since we needed a UN resolution, the only UN history on which we could hang our hat for invading Iraq was Saddam's failure to live up to the WMD requirements. I mean, that's where the whole WMD thing came from. It wasn't there before. It was part of our legitimate response to having been attacked on September 11th, and he was part of the network. That's what it was originally all about. But, you know, Blair needed these votes. It's the lawyers, as usual. I'm sorry. I mean, we're on this wonderful firm. It's people asking. It's a person I work with a lot. It's a wonderful man. But, I mean, the lawyers really are bad.
Very nice.
Foreign policy. Yes, sir.
We'll take this question now.
You say or imply that I think that the American leadership, the government leadership, didn't have the foggiest idea of what they're dealing with, in the sense that they didn't understand Muslim history, culture, the Quran, and the people who really made the decisions, like Cheney and Bush, didn't understand or know what they were dealing with. You mentioned about Iran. Is this true? Would you agree?
No, I wouldn't say that. I don't know. What I would say is that for 25 years, no American president and no American administration was prepared to fight the terror war. That's number one.
That doesn't change the fact.
That's number one. Number two, this is
our government attacked Iraq and got involved in the quagmire without understanding any of the background of history, culture, or theology.
No, I wouldn't say that either. In fact, if you go through recent administrations, this one in that context is one of the best. I mean, these are people, I mean, Cheney talks to Bernard Lewis all the time. You can't imagine how many times Bernard Lewis has been to Washington to talk to the vice president, to talk to Condoleezza Rice, to talk to the president, to talk to the state. I mean, on the contrary, this is an administration which has devoted a hell of a lot of man hours to discussing exactly that. I mean, that said, the policy, I mean, which I'm not particularly happy with, but anyway, I mean, the policy doesn't really reflect the way Bernard looks at the world, but no one elected him, you know? No one elected me, so they're making their decision.
Yes, a question about atomic threat from Iran. Do you think Israel should blow up the atomic center there like they did in Iraq? Should we just not do anything? Are they ready to? I mean, do they have bombs?
Well, they're certainly, whether they have them or not, I can't tell you. All I can say is that historically, we have always been wrong about when a country would develop nuclear weapons. We've always been too cheery about it. We have always been surprised. Right, we're surprised that the Soviet bomb, the Chinese bomb, the Indian and the Pakistani bombs. I mean, every time somebody tests a bomb, we're surprised. And that has always happened. Okay, so now the official estimate is what? About 2 years. Two, 3 years. The Israeli estimate is 6 months to a year and a half. Right? I mean, no one... Well, I mean, who knows? Maybe it's tomorrow. Maybe it's a month from now. Maybe it's 5 years from now. We don't know. All we know is that the Iranians are going all out to build a nuclear weapon. And we know other things. We know that Rafsanjani has said publicly a quite alarming thing, which is he has said, the minute we get this, we're going to drop it on Israel. And we don't care if Israel responds, because it'll be a great deal for Islam. We will have destroyed half the Jews, and they will have gotten 8% of the Muslims. What a deal. Okay, now, you know, all the smart people say, well, you know, the domestic consumption, pounding his chest, crazy Iranians, and so forth. But we've lived through now more than half a century in which it's quite spectacular how many times people who say these crazy things really mean them. And as soon as they get the opportunity, really do them. Right? I mean, I remember back in 1979, there were three of us in Washington got Khomeini texts. Right? And got them translated. Steve Rosenfeld at the Washington Post, Judy Miller at the New York Times, and me. And we all wrote them. I wrote it in the Wall Street Journal. They wrote it in their own newspapers. And basically what we wrote, I mean, we had different parts of it. We had different themes. Basically what we said is, you think the Shah's bad? What if this guy takes over? All right, so these things were all published. And Skip Jackson held hearings because he was very alarmed. He got some of these translations also. And he called in the CIA and said, well, what about this Khomeini person? And what about these things, these things. The CIA said, well, we think it's an Israeli forgery. That is, that they're just trying to get us to, you know, to think, etc. So, you know, we're not, it's been a long time. I mean, our failure to understand that part of the world and who these people are and what they're really capable of. So, I mean, it goes back a long time. I mean, don't focus on one of this administration, for all its failings, and it has lots of failings, like every other administration. This is one of the best. And on this particular subject, it's hands down the best. In fact, it's not only the best one, it's the only one that's ever tried to defend us from these people. Okay, they'll get it all. Okay, I mean, I was against doing Iraq before Iran, and I was against doing Iraq this way, but still you have to do Iraq. All right, so they did it. They did it imperfectly. I mean, human history is the history of people.
But you say, Iran should have been done first. What would have been the timing? What would have been...
Revolution. I mean, when we came out of Afghanistan, if Bush had stood up and said, we want regime change in Iran. Iran is the world's leading sponsor of terrorism. Iran has been the number one country on the State Department's list of terrorist supporters forever, since the list was created. It's always Iran. Right? And there's a linkage between those two things. It's the greatest tyranny in the Middle East, it's the most powerful tyranny, and it's the greatest sponsor of terrorism. And they hate us, and where did Osama go after Afghanistan? He went to Iran. What's the world's most dangerous terrorist organization? Don't say Al-Qaeda.
Hezbollah.
Hezbollah is an Iranian creation. Imad Bukhniya goes to Tehran for instructions, for money, for plans, for intelligence, and so forth. It's run out of Tehran. So after Afghanistan, when we had the whole region at our mercy, instead of fussing around with the United Nations and trying to save Claire from being prosecuted by Judge Garzon, we should have stood up and said, you know, the Iranian people, God bless them, they demonstrated for us, they love us, we love them, let's work together, let's change the regime in Iran. I promise you, within 2 or 3 months, that regime would have been history. They would have run. We couldn't have resisted that.
Yeah.
Yes, ma'am.
Wait a second.
I have a woman here first and then ladies first. Yes, ma'am.
Why was Iraq not taken out in 1991?
Because, why was Iraq not taken out in 1991? Because we fell prey to various things. Above all, it is when you say to yourself, I don't have to get involved in this dirty business, they will do it for me. And so they convinced themselves that the Kurds and the Shiites would do it for them. So we didn't have to, you know, we didn't have to kill all those people on the highway of death and so forth. Yes, sir?
The influence of the State Department.
Yes.
That seems to be crucial.
Yes.
What can you do about it?
What can you do about the influence of the State Department is have a president who tells the Secretary of State they didn't want to hear this nonsense and, you know, it's my policy and your people are wrong and I was elected and they weren't. And this is what we're going to do. And if you don't want to do it, you know, go back to America Online or whatever you want to be. You know, go back to giving speeches at $60,000. Yes, sir.
Let's say you've got a regime change in Iran.
Yes.
Let's be really optimistic and actually the regime change. You see that probably Clinton would also get rid of the Saudi, the royal family. Now, how do you prevent the Muslims from the familiar or terrible Muslim pattern when they... Thought to bring you a liberator and happy you let yourself to start an insurgency and try to drag you up to Lebanon and what we have now in Iraq and so on.
Well, I can't solve all the problems at once. I will tell you that I have every confidence that in Iran, none of that would happen because the Iranians, first of all, are not Arabs. They're different. They hate Arabs. I mean, I've never encountered hatred of Arabs as intense as the Arab hatred I encounter in every Iranian I know of, whatever political persuasion. And Iran is and has been for a very long time the Iranian people who are very pro-American. And we're not going to occupy Iran any more than we're going to occupy Syria or Saudi Arabia, my scenario. My scenario is supporting them to liberate themselves. I don't want to invade and occupy. I mean, Iraq was, oddly enough, the one country which we had to invade. I don't see any other way to do it, although we could have done it a lot better. And we could have had a lot more politics in it, and we could have bombed them with pamphlets, and we could have created free Iraq zones and the no-fly zones north and south, and we could have created a democratic Iraqi government in exile, whose most likely and most talented president would have been the person who we just attacked today in Baghdad, because, I mean, only the CIA could come up with something as magnificently stupid as that. But there you go. We've surrounded Ahmad Chalabi's house and the offices of the INC in Baghdad for some reason. Yes, we've carted off computers and files and so on and so forth. We're looking.
He worked for us.
No. I mean, he would have worked for us, except that, I mean, in a way, would have worked with us, not for us. But the State Department and CIA have always hated him. And an enormous amount of our mistakes in Iraq can be explained because we were more preoccupied with preventing Ahmed from coming to power than we were with liberating the country and empowering the Iraqi people.
He has been right.
Okay, sorry.
We went into Iraq first. One of the reasons was weapons of mass destruction. To the present, the president claims he was misled or he was saying he's not in authority.
Well, it's a loaded question. We can all add, right? No, but I mean, those aren't the only two options. The president said it because the CIA and every other intelligence service in the entire civilized world thought it was true, without exception. There wasn't a one that didn't think it was true. And probably it was true, furthermore. So that if you say it's not possible that every intelligence service in the Western world was wrong on this question, then the real issue becomes, well, so what happened to it?
That was the follow-up question that you just
had. And the answer is, probably some of it went to Iran, some of it went to Syria, and some of it didn't. And I don't know, I mean, things happen, but nobody pays any attention. The government of Sudan officially communicated to Syria the other day that Syria had to remove their WMDs from Sudan. Right? A story that hasn't received a lot of comment. Then there was the sarin cell, right? The chemical weapon that was aimed against us in the streets of Iraq. Page 18 of the New York Times. Not mentioned what? Well, all right, but I mean, the official tendency is to bury it, you know, and lots of other such things. I mean, we found so many WMDs in Iraq right now that if you just added it all up, yeah, you wouldn't be asking this question anymore. I mean, there's lots of stuff that we found. Yes.
You seem relatively sanguine, though, that once you decapitate or take off these oppressive regimes, that the underlying societies or the revolutions or whatnot will yield something marginally or. Reasonable. If you look throughout the entire Arab world, 22 countries, it's the only part of the world that has a single regime approaching democracy, whether, as you said, they're Islamists on the one hand, whether, as you point out, they're socialists on the other, radically different types of people. The common theme is oppression. And if you think that democracy is the solution, well, we do have one example of Arab people in the Middle East who live under democracy, who have freedom of speech, you know, who have rising economic damage, and they're the least of all. Whether it be the Israeli Arabs in 1948, or the West Bank and Gaza Arabs who lived under Israeli control from 1967 to 1994. So, why do you think that these people, that the solution is to do anything other than perhaps, I don't know, take the oil fields and just deprive them of their source of income so that they're restored to being this kind of, you know, nomadic, backwards people? Because anything else that leaves them with money in a modern world is
doesn't seem to be something that they can deliver.
Well, every democratic country in the world except us used to be undemocratic. Right? I mean, there's not a democracy chromosome that's somehow lacking in the DNA of the Arab world. They can do it. It's not that hard. And many of them would like to do it. Many of them don't want to do it. And there's places like, I mean, somebody mentioned Algeria a while back, where left to their own devices, they installed or wanted to install radical Islamic tyranny. The Iranians freely chose Khomeini, right? Germans and Italians were wild for Hitler and Mussolini, I remind you. And yet, and at the end of World War II, by the way, the State Department, if you go read George F. Kennan, the saintly, said at the end of World War II, there are no Democrats in Germany, there are no people in Germany who know how to be Democratic, so we have to work with the Nazi bureaucracy and infrastructure because at least they know how to run a country.
Well, they killed 10% of the population, which gets their attention.
No, we've killed an awful lot of people in Iraq, and that's gotten the Iraqis' attention, and it's attracted the attention of the whole Middle East, believe me. They noticed it, and in fact, they noticed it in a way that severely undermines one of the basic premises of the jihadists, which is that Americans won't fight hand-to-hand and man-to-man, because one of the things that happened in Iraq was that they had the misfortune of running up against the United States Marine Corps, who loved to fight hand-to-hand and man-to-man, and you know, hardly a Marine was scratched in those things. The only way they can kill Marines is at long distance. They're the ones who won't fight it, and it turns out we fight the reverse. If we were good at propaganda, we could have a lot of fun.
One more question. That's all we'll have time for.
Anyway, I'll hang around. So.
Where do you see the situation in Iraq going? I mean, will the United States seek some indigenous leaders and then turn it over and get out to the future?
No, it's not the same thing. Yes, we're going to seek, we and the wretched Brahimi from the United Nations, who's best known in the Middle East as having turned the Lebanese over to the Syrians in 1989, and therefore does not inspire confidence among the Iraqi people. Anyway, yes, we're going to seek local leaders who will govern the country, to whom we will turn over the governments on the 1st of July or the 30th or the 31st. Of June, 30 days of September, 30th of June. I mean, we wanted to do that a lot. I mean, we wanted the United Nations involved from the beginning. We didn't throw out or lock out the United Nations. The United Nations ran. They were there. They were bond. They refused security from us because they said, well, we're the United Nations. No one's here. They're not going to attack us. Then they were attacked, and then they ran. Right, so we wanted that from the beginning too. I mean, wrongly in my opinion, but I mean that's neither here nor there. So yes, we're going to turn it over, but no, we're not going to leave. So there will be an Iraqi government, but our military forces will remain, as we put it, as long as that government wants us to stay. So how long is that? I don't know. Go ahead.
Iraq, to begin with, is not this arbitrary boundaries created after World War I. What leads you to believe that it is possible or desirable to keep it intact as one country now?
Look, if they want to break it up, it's fine with me. I haven't heard. I have not heard. I know a lot of political science types are running around now saying, and there's a thing by Leslie Gelt today in the Wall Street Journal saying, well, you know, why don't we partition Iraq? I mean, the Kurdish part works well. Let's let it be itself, let it go on its own, and so on and so forth. Well, I mean, ask the Turks how they would respond to an independent Kurdistan. It drives them off the wall. It's a provocation. I mean, it's a catastrophe in that part of the country. Everybody says, well, you know, Iraq is an arbitrary creation. It's true. Some colonial power drew a few lines on the map and said, okay, this is a country, henceforth, right? That's all of Africa. Every single African country is like that. And almost every boundary in Europe is arbitrary in the sense that the boundary was drawn because a war ended there. And when they decided to stop fighting, these guys were on opposite sides of the river. And so the river was the boundary between this country and that country. I mean, why does Belgium exist? for starters. I mean, you think there's divisions between Sunnis, Shiites, and Kurds. Try Flemings, Walloons, and so forth. You know, what are we talking about? So what's the big deal? What's so special about Iraq? Iraqis have a sense of national identity. Iraqis have, and Iraq, that entity, not within precisely the same boundaries, but grosso modo those boundaries, has been a concept and an operational unit and an administrative unit of the Ottoman Empire for centuries. Right? So, I mean, you can split up any country you want. I mean, and there's always people who want to do it. Right? There's Corsicans who want to split off from France. There's, you know, Neapolitans who never wanted to be part of Italy in the first place and are only there because they were occupied and dragged in. I mean, if you give them a referendum, they'll be gone in 24 hours.
Let me wind up officially.
All right.
We do have to wind up officially, but Michael can't be considered to say and answer more questions informally, so please come up and ask them. But I do want to, at this juncture, thank you all for attending. Thank you, Michael. We'll continue to speak to you informally here, but we thank him for his illuminating and entertaining.